Welcome, friends of the Libra Solutions Network. My name is Gabriel, and I'm here to encourage people to build and take part in a better digital future. Today, I'm recording on September 9th, 2025, and I am very sorry that this update is coming late. The fact of the matter is, there has been a lot going on in my life, and I really do want to get this out. If for no other reason, there are some important stories I want to add some context to that I think you would be really interested in. First up, I have a really cool update on my side of things where I set up in the last recap XMR Chat, which is a Monero donation tool for the Libra Solutions Network, and I am happy to say that I got my first tip thanks to Hunter, who says, "Great work, Gabe, keep it up." I have a suspicion this has to do with one of my ongoing projects that I will be talking about shortly, but all the same, it is very appreciated and I really enjoy trying out new things. And I think XMR Chat is a great model for how we can decentralize tipping online because you can host your own XMR Chat instance. You don't have to use the main one at xmrchat.com, which is honestly kind of cool. As somebody who's tried it out and verified everything works now, thanks to I have a donation, I can say that it's a pretty cool option. I think it would pair very well with some of the other things you can do in the decentralized media space. And so getting right to it, I feel like the first stop shop is the website. LibraSolutions.network is where you'll find all my stuff, all my links, especially as I highlighted in the last update. There are now darknet links, so if you are trying to access the Libra Solutions Network over Tor and I2P hidden services, these are available, as well as it has a link to XMR Chat and other places to donate, but as well as the RSS feed, which is really important because it's really important to have a way to get updates on any kinds of content in a way that you're not censored. And this is something I take very strongly. I think it is very important that as censorship is ramping up worldwide in more extreme ways, that we have to do everything we can to make not only our own work resilient to censorship, but also as an audience member, participate in censorship resistance by using tools that actually do resolve these problems. Of course, if you haven't heard about RSS, my RSS feed actually includes information on how you can get started, including at the Corbett Report or indieweb.org. There are many great resources for getting started in case you're new. Now, because I feel so strongly about this, I am actually adding a little button to the website that says, "Want more decentralization? Love the web? Hate censorship? Your feedback is needed." You click here. This goes to a demo where I talk about the RSS reader I am currently building and have been doing a lot of behind the scenes work. I don't have a major visual overhaul, but I did reach a really cool milestone lately, where if I can show it off here, it actually now will work with Tor and I2P. So if you're trying to access information over the dark web, it will actually work. Now, of course, this is a very early project. It is in active development. This is a learning project on my end, but I actually think it already has the features to be a significant game changer moving forward. And so I have a suspicion maybe part of the reason Hunter left me a tip is because he might be interested in what I'm building here. I'm very excited for how it's going to work because I'm really getting the features in. Now, the graphical side of it is because I want non-technical people to be able to use this. So I need to actually build a desktop application. Because it's all well and good if I build something that, you know, super techies can use secretly, but I really do appreciate that you can actually use the Tor browser, discover a website, and then hook it up to this reader. Another feature I have in mind that I'm very excited once that's built into the system is when one site links to another, I want you to be able to discover other RSS feeds, which is something that I will say is not built into many of the RSS readers in ways that people are used to working with. So I want to make the user interface directly call it out. It's like, oh, you can find more things. And then that will really help make this a game-changing censorship resistant technology, because then now it doesn't matter what network you're on, whether you're hosting your site on I2P, on Tor, or on the regular internet, they can all kind of mesh together is the goal of this system. And so exciting things are up ahead. I'm very happy with how this project is coming along, and I would recommend taking a look at the issues. These are all the features I currently intend to support. I spent a lot of work lately just kind of categorizing and really getting things ready. And the important thing here is the milestones. The 1.0, this is what I want to have done before it's actually ready, but I do have some fancy ideas for the future. For instance, one of the things I'm really excited to put in is, phase two, is Piper text-to-speech. Yeah, with and that will allow you to read, you know, articles and content in RSS audibly, which is something that I honestly probably need on some level, because I am more of an audio type person than necessarily a reading and writing type person. And so I'm really looking forward to many interesting features that this can eventually have as I spend more time on it. And so I am sharing this, if for no other reason, to be accountable about the fact that I am working on it. Part of the reason you're not going to hear from me as much over this month is because I am going to be trying to get these issues solved, especially the ones in the 1.0 milestone, because that stuff I want to have done by the end of the year. I'm very excited to get this done, and so I am going to be pushing hard on getting it done. Of course, I haven't been completely silent. Over the last month, I wrote a couple of articles, namely, chatbot psychosis is actually a really big deal. I wanted to write this article specifically because I think people vastly underestimate how much technological and social problems are downstream of our real human condition. It's very easy to look at these things and recognize the predatory nature of how these consolidated systems transform our social lives. But I think it's also very crucial to understand that this is something that we need to tackle by understanding the human roots of these technical problems and not necessarily just straight up scapegoat the systems. Because truthfully, although I'm not a huge fan of how these systems operate and I understand the concerns that people have, I do think it is just as important to wrestle with the human side of what makes these serious problems. Next up, I responded to some feedback I got from an email. Somebody wrote to me basically asking, what good is hope if digital ID comes in and you will have to use your real life identity with your internet service provider? Truthfully, if you are using a data plan, such as a mobile phone, you already have an internet connection that is associated with your real life identity. What I think many people are concerned about is when most of the services they use require linking their real life identity to various actions online and the surveillance problems that that creates. And I think that's a serious issue. But the fact of the matter is, when it comes to state level surveillance, there are many ways a state level actor can get access to what you are doing specifically, unless you are very diligent about your privacy online, which is certainly a high bar to reach. The thing is that just because state-level actors may or may not have complete omniscient looks into your lifestyle and what you're doing online, I still think there is a really important reason to consider privacy-protecting tools, security-protecting tools against other actors. There are many other scenarios in life where it, just because you may or may not be able to protect yourself from the state, which is still important, I still think you should try in whatever ways you think are worth it to you. But the fact of the matter is, there are other threats that are very much worth taking seriously. And my go-to example is, just because as a Canadian, the government of Canada can very easily get information about what I'm up to, that doesn't necessarily mean I want to give it all to Google. I mean, those are different levels you can make. And I think to the degree we can make choices, we should be very particular about how we want to make those choices. And so this was an interesting bit of feedback I got, and I wrote up a bit of an answer. And the truth of it really does boil down to hostile cyberspace. If we are using digital infrastructure that is not built by us, is not run by us, is not controlled by the people fundamentally, that is going to create a real problem. And it's interesting because the UN has this digital public infrastructure plan in place. And the truth of the matter is that will have many of the same problems we have with corporate digital infrastructure, which is why I think what is truly necessary to resolve many of these problems is building up independent digital infrastructure. And that is what I advocate for first and foremost. And so I understand the despair, I understand the frustration, I understand, honestly, the hopelessness. As somebody who's been wrestling with this directly, I totally understand it. But I do think it is important to realize that there are always good moves you can make, even when things look incredibly bleak. And last up, another article I wrote, which is, "You Can't Please Everybody, Censorship in Decentralized Networks." This is going to connect to a theme I'm going to talk about in one of the emerging stories moving forwards. But the thing is that many people want decentralized social media to solve all of the technological and human problems we have. And I like decentralized social media. I like the Fediverse. I like Noster. I like even some of the other fancier systems out there like Manyverse. There are many interesting systems that people have put together. But the truth of the matter is that digital freedom is not just a technological challenge, it is also a social one. It does not matter if a couple of people go to the Fediverse, set up their own instances, and chat amongst themselves if nobody comes along to join them. And one of the biggest barriers to the Fediverse actually taking on to be a real challenge to power or anything important is the fact that there is a bit of a censor culture on the Mastodon network as far as that side of the Fediverse is concerned, because there is a desire to use the server-to-server blocking functionality that has to exist on some level because it is a decentralized network. Nobody can decide what the rules are for everybody, but server-to-server blocking can interfere with individuals communicating, and that is something people are really interested in trying to solve. There's some very interesting work by Silverpill, the developer of Mitra, trying to work on this issue a bit. But also Noster is another solution that tries to sidestep this by getting rid of moderation at the, say, server level. You as a user are not beholden to any server, but your messages are then kind of associated with every relay. And so there are trade-offs with how these systems work, and I just wanted to raise, I guess, the level of awareness and detail people may or may not understand about these decentralized networks. You cannot force the entire network to play by a particular set of rules for both and ill. It is hard because I recognize the desire to want to have everybody in one network that we all use and we can all chat interoperably with it, but the truth of the matter is decentralized networks have different trade-offs, and these trade-offs are important to consider when we're trying to make use of them. So the first story today is about Google, and specifically the future of Android. I was following the antitrust case very carefully. Lunduk did a lot of great reporting on this. The Reclaim the Net did a lot of great reporting on this. And the big concern I had was what was going to happen to Android, because up until this point, many people felt like using de-Googled Android phones was basically the solution to smartphone privacy and security. And in some ways, that's true. But there was a fear that if Google was made to get rid of Android, that would be disruptive. Now, truthfully, I think some of that disruption could have been good. I think if Google was made to get rid of Android as part of their antitrust prosecution, that maybe there would be a better future for Android as far as decentralization and openness. But the truth of the matter is that that's not what happened. The federal judge basically got away with a lot of the speculated, the federal judge basically tossed that away. Google's basically got a glorified slap on the wrist that I am honestly, personally kind of frustrated with. And at the same time, where it comes to Android directly, is that at the same time that Google is basically being allowed to run a monopoly over so much of people's digital lives, they are now tightening the screws on the system that they run. And so a big part of this is the restriction of what you can install on your Android device. For those who are running Apple and iOS, they may not be familiar that you can install applications from things other than the Google Store. And this is a significant game changer because many independent developers trying to build useful privacy tools generally try to build it on Android because you don't have to contend with certain gatekeepers. You can just use the tool as it exists and build the software to run on it. And this is a very concerning change because in the context of other things that are going on in Android right now. This is kind of the last stop when it comes to, is Android even useful as a freedom technology? And so it's very important to consider, what are we doing to foster an ecosystem where independent technical skills can actually flourish? Because if everybody developing something for smartphones, which I assume is the preferred computing platform for most people these days, if you actually want to reach the public, you will have to contend with smartphones on some level. And so I think it is very important when we recognize that, yes, de-Googling your Android device will make some progress. Ultimately, if nobody has any reason to develop for Android because of these restrictions, that has serious impacts on the future of freedom tech on smartphones as a whole. Specifically regarding the phrase sideloading, Eugen Rocco, the developer of Mastodon, has a great statement here, which is that sideloading is the rent seeker word for being able to run software of your choosing on a computing device you purchased. There is no reasonable case for an operating system developer having a say over what programs you run on your hardware. And that's the really concerning thing about where we are right now. There is a real serious drive for operating systems and hardware manufacturers to try to lock down these systems, because then they can sell that control to governments. Ah, see, we have all your citizens under control because we can determine what they can and can't do. And then there will be back and forth deals, legislations, all kind of plans about how they can basically eliminate digital and actual dissent. And that is a very serious issue that I think is worth paying attention to. Of course, it's very easy to see a problem and people kind of lose their mind about this. They're kind of like, oh, is this game over? Is this the end? Is this the end of, does this mean there's no way out? And oddly enough, somebody specifically tagged GrapheneOS, which is actually really good at answering questions if people talk to them on X. And GrapheneOS states that it doesn't impact GrapheneOS because it doesn't have Google Mobile Services. If you install and use Google Mobile Services, Google Play, on GrapheneOS, they run as regular sandbox apps, so they can't block installing apps. Nothing for us to do because it's a non-issue. So it's important to realize that if you are using a de-Googled phone that is actually truly de-Googled and, well, truly independent from these systems, you will sidestep these restrictions, which is important. This is a big win for GrapheneOS. This is a big win for any other operating system on Android that has the same features, but there is a downside here. And the fact of the matter is GrapheneOS users are a pretty small percentage of, well, the smartphone market as a whole. And so I think if we are concerned about the future of, well, digital independence on smartphones, I know many people are going to point out that that is arguably a contradiction in terms, but to what degree there are more independent systems on these platforms, we have to seriously contend with what we want to do about it. And this is the recurring theme I really want to drive home in this update, that across all these different issues, the issue is not purely technical. The issue is not purely, oh, GrapheneOS has fixed this for everybody, so we can all just, you know, say it's solved and, you know, tell people, oh, well, if you're not on GrapheneOS, you just don't care. It's more complicated than that, because currently not a lot of people are on GrapheneOS. And I think it would be better if more people were, and more importantly, if GrapheneOS was more supported. Actually, because of some of the changes Google is making to Pixel and how they release Android open source project packages, what's basically going on right now is that they are making it harder to target particular Android devices with builds of Android open source project. And so GrapheneOS, because of this, is going to be building their own reference device. They are currently in deals with OEMs to build a new GrapheneOS device, which I think will be a game changer when it comes out. But it's very important that we don't just, you know, use these things and keep them to ourselves. I think it's critical that when we discover and use these digital freedom tools, we have to bring them to other people. We have to share them. We have to figure out what are the barriers making it hard for other people to get into. Because the GrapheneOS web installer is very simple to use, but many people find that conceptual step of, oh, I have to install a different operating system onto this phone or even on their computer. For a lot of people, switching to Linux was a big hurdle for things they were trying to accomplish. And so it is very important that we really wrestle with the issue of how do we bring these things to more people? Because ultimately, we need the broader society to connect with the needs we care about. We need the broader society to understand why we value these things. If Gabriel is just some weird guy out there all alone, you know, huddled from the rest of the world, and then, you know, using these digital solutions to stay, to hide from the system, ultimately, how many people does that help? In the best case scenario, it helps one, which is me. But if we can normalize and really push hard for people who arguably, you know, don't need the most secure setup, arguably don't need, you know, aren't too worried about their privacy, if we can get them to understand the benefits of independence and understand the benefits of decentralization and how the consolidation of power in the digital space has been used against them, I think there's a lot that can be done to bring attention to all the ways in which things can be better. And so this, to me, is really not just about Android. This is not just about GrapheneOS. This is about a broader understanding of what freedom tech is and how we should use it in our own lives, as well as bringing it to the lives of others. Which is why the next thing I want to talk about is actually the hash rate war going on in Monero. You could say it's ongoing, but in general, it was a big event over the last month. And so to distill it down to the simplest level, because I don't know how much people know about cryptocurrency and how, what level I should take this to, but the important detail here is there are many different ways to run cryptocurrency systems. And what made cryptocurrency a big change over the rest of the digital landscape was that they were proof of work. So Bitcoin was the first cryptocurrency. Bitcoin used proof of work with SHA-256, which is a hashing algorithm, which basically means you're doing math. These proof of work systems are using math to secure the systems so that that allows people to basically drop in and drop out. There's no like one provider. There's no Bitcoin server that can be shut down. There are dozens, if not thousands, of Bitcoin nodes, because they're not servers, they're nodes really that connect to each other and interact. And so Monero is another cryptocurrency that also uses proof of work. Proof of work is a consensus mechanism. And what a consensus mechanism is it means that the system needs a way to understand what is the true state, what transactions have and have not happened, how do we determine this? And so the way proof of work solves this is the more math that has been done, the more computing power that has been used, the more energy that has been spent recording a particular sequence of events, that is the sequence we defer to, because that means rewriting history becomes exponentially harder. That is the idea behind it. And so that creates this vector that people are concerned about called a 51% attack. Because if you control a majority of the hash rate, i.e. the math and energy and computing power going into running the system, the consensus algorithm, you can basically decide what the history is. The more of a percentage, if you had, for example, if you had 100% of the computing power going into the network, you could rewrite history as a whole. You could build your own chains and do all kinds of silly stuff that basically defeats the purpose of using a cryptocurrency. So a 51% attack, but more importantly, the consolidation of hash rate on the network itself is a serious issue, even whether it does or does not hit 51%. 51% isn't really a magical number per se, but it is an important number when it comes to where on the consolidation ladder are you in these problems. And so yes, if a particular actor is able to control more than 51% over significant periods of time, it allows nasty things to happen. But the truth is you don't actually need a full 51%. There was a lot of interesting discussion going on about, could we even verify whether this attacker going after the Monero network actually had 51% of the network? Because what was happening is that there were these events called reorgs, reorganization. So as I mentioned, blockchain has one history of events that is recorded with a consensus algorithm. But the thing is if you wanted to rewrite that history, you could simply build a longer chain and then all the other systems have to, all the other nodes have to adopt your sequence of events. And so one, this is entirely destructive and disruptive to the users and is generally a sign that somebody is getting a significant control of the network. As of the time of the writing of this particular piece, it was deduced that Cubic had closer to 30% of their hash rate rather than the majority. And this is an important detail because I think it can kind of be lost on people how information is kind of distorted in decentralized networks, because you only know what your node sees. And people can publish their node and show, you know, what information their node can see. But ultimately, the network does what it does. And so it's hard if somebody isn't engaging honestly. If Cubic just outright said, oh, we had 51 or 60 or 80% of the hash rate, how do you verify this? Because there was a tool online about that showed the different mining pools and their hash rate. But that was basically just asking those pools and those systems, hey, what's your hash rate? There wasn't really a real validation going on. So there was a bit of investigation going on here where people were trying to figure out, hey, how much hash rate is actually being used. And so anyways, another thing worth touching on is just Anti-Moonboy. I did an interview with him a while back, and he's been covering this ongoing development quite a bit. I'm also going to include Monero Talk. There was a great episode on the entire discussion of what they want to do about this whole attack and what they want to may or may not want to change about Monero moving forward to respond to this. But it is a big deal. And so I really like Anti-Moonboy. I like his show and I like his coverage of this issue. He's been very detailed, and this episode in particular touches on it quite a bit. And so if you are interested in the specifics of this attack on Monero, this might be a great place to start, though there are many other resources that I also covered in the last update as well. But there was an interesting thing, again, hat tip to Silverpill, the developer of Mitra, who pointed this in my direction, because I was highly suspicious that this is the case. This is a theory that was thrown out there, and I wholeheartedly believe this is the case. I actually believe that the true target of this particular attack is not even Monero itself, but its consensus algorithm, because I've explained to you how proof of work uses energy, computing power, and math to deduce the state of the decentralized system. I don't think proof of work is perfect, but one of the reasons I'm going to share with you a Monero Talk episode in the links here is because this guy, Arctic Mind, did a great job pointing out there are serious problems with how proof of stake operates. And the best way to sum up his arguments boils down to, in cryptocurrency, there is a phrase, not your keys, not your coins. This is important because if you're using crypto on, say, an exchange or in some kind of custodial service, and now, you know, EU is starting to mandate hosted wallets, so there's all kinds of things that can go in that direction. And so how proof of stake works is, instead of using math and computing power and energy, which is sometimes branded as an eco-friendly move, what proof of stake does is basically whoever ties up the most coins, or sometimes there's different ways of making it out, but basically is that the big holders of the cryptocurrency will make decisions. So they'll run their nodes, they'll stake their coins by basically tying up a certain amount of their savings in this cryptocurrency to make decisions. In my opinion, even at this level, this just means any cryptocurrency is effectively just controlled by a cabal of its biggest holders if it's running proof of stake. And the fact of the matter is, many proof of stake cryptocurrencies will have pre-binds, which means they'll give themselves a huge share of the total supply, either to fund development or even just to have it as a reward for creating the system. And that's a really different ballgame than a proof of work coin. There is very different incentives involved, but the argument in favor of proof of stake by many people is that proof of stake is more secure. It has a higher security budget. It costs more for security, but the trade-off you're making there is you're trusting the big holders of these cryptocurrencies. Now, another problem with proof of stake, and this is what Arctic Mind was alluding to in the Monero Talk episode, is that if exchanges or other custodial holders hold on to other people's coins, they control that stake. And I think this is a big part of the reason why the VC space loves proof of stake. I think this is a big part of the reason why proof of stake is so popular in the seedier aspects of the cryptocurrency community, because what happens is you kind of have this loop where somebody will create a proof of stake coin or convert a coin that they may or may not have a significant amount of to proof of stake. Then they basically allow the coins to consolidate on various custodial exchanges, because people do tend to naturally gravitate towards what's easier, and custodial exchanges are the easy place to transact. And it's worth pointing out that proof of work is no magic bullet. If an exchange wants to do nasty things, they can't directly subvert the proof of work mechanism, but there are other things exchanges can do to undermine proof of work coins. But it's just kind of terrifying how much consolidation of the supply is something that is encouraged in proof of stake because it gives people real power over the system. And so I have always been a vocal critic of proof of stake. And when I first saw this discussion over Monero and how it was being covered in the mainstream cryptocurrency press, I wholeheartedly agree with this assertion that the true target was not Monero itself, but actually its proof of work consensus algorithm. And I think there is a real desire to undermine what Monero is, even if I'm willing to acknowledge no system is perfect. I don't think it makes sense to be dogmatic about these tools. I think it's important to really just learn the lessons we can so that if all else fails, we can build something new with better foundations than what has come before. And so I think it's really important to dive deep into these issues. I think it's really important to learn what we can from these things because there's so much to learn if we really delve into the details. And of course, this also does have real consequences. Monero actually was delisted in Canada on one of the largest cryptocurrency exchanges, Kraken, which is very well known and basically a major centralized custodial exchange that people are used to using with. So these events do have a serious impact on the future of these projects for both good and ill. It is important to understand that things change, things evolve. You can't always assume that these systems will always exist in the way that they have. And this is certainly not the first time Monero has been delisted from exchange, but it did seem like Kraken was one of the last few holdouts. And it's interesting that it's Canada, not just because I myself am a Canadian, but I find Canada has been, as many people know, much more interested in financial repression and financial control over its citizens than, say, other jurisdictions that's like the UK, which may be going after more of the privacy and the censorship route. So it is important to keep in mind that maybe different jurisdictions have different threats. And so the last trend I want to talk about here is really how decentralized social media has friction with the changes that are going on right now. And I'm opening with this great article here by Cheapsakes. Some of the new US state social media laws are driving away small social media because really many of us acknowledge there are problems with how big tech has operated large-scale social media platforms and media platforms across the board. But it seems like we're not interested in cutting back on their power over our digital lives and society as a whole. It seems that instead we're going to try to make them more tyrannical by enforcing ID laws as a way of entrenching their monopoly. And we're supposed to believe that this is somehow going to make them more benevolent towards the users when, as far as I'm concerned, it's all hostile cyberspace. And so we're at a critical time where these restrictions are being imposed in ways that make it not clear what are the risks of running a really public and decentralized social media system. And so this is a very important ongoing trend that I think really should be paid attention to. Of course, the big reason I wanted to highlight this particular article on this topic is because of this passage right here. Anonymity is vital for the exercise of free speech. Journalists understand that. The framers of the US Constitution understood it at times, practice it themselves. Even governments understand it, especially when they need informants to help them collect the taxes they feel are owed. Yet somehow, this understanding is not filtering down to the masses of social media users. And state legislators seem to be able to forget about the importance of free speech whenever convenient. As many who are reading this may be aware, anonymity allows individuals to voice truths that they may not otherwise be willing to speak, and governments often hate that. To quote the 2013 source linked in the previous sentence, some governments will consider it too risky to have thousands of anonymous, untraceable, and unverified citizens, hidden people. They'll want to know who is associated with each online account and will require verification at a state level in order to exert control over the virtual world. A truer prediction has never been uttered. And that, I think, is the crux of the fork in the road we're at when it comes to our digital future. Do we want a digital future where anonymity online is possible, is something that is normal and expected in many circumstances, and it allows people to voice concerns that they may be afraid of genuine retaliation or even consequences for speaking out about things that people either don't want to hear, are not ready to face, or have serious ramifications for people running enterprises that may profit off some problem or some issue. There are many ways in which this really does manifest in important ways, and I think there is a real desire by the power structures that exist nowadays that they absolutely want to put a lid on any kind of discussion, and that's why you'll see so many people who, let's just say, are very friendly with the regime right now, saying, oh, well, you should say that with your real face. And that is why I am not perfectly anonymous. The fact of the matter is, I want to advocate for anonymity as much as humanly possible, and in doing so, I have given up my anonymity so that I can dispel the criticism of, oh, you're just a coward for not showing your face. And I do value anonymity. I do think that it is very important to have conversations that don't tie directly to one's identity. And I think there are many important reasons why that should be seen as fundamental to our digital experience, at least as an option people can have. I get it. Not everybody is going to value anonymity, but I feel obligated by the fact that I'm talking about things publicly at all, that I recognize that because I am using my real face and because I am, you know, being very public about who I am and what I'm doing, there are definitely topics that it is not safe to talk about. And that's kind of the problem right now, is everybody wants everybody to be perfectly courageous and say everything that comes to their mind all the time. But I don't think that's a fair expectation, and I think so much more could get done if we actually had a healthy helping of online spaces to discuss things that are important, but maybe aren't suited for the general public conversation. Maybe part of the problem here is that people do need a space to express themselves and wrestle with difficult issues that is outside the discussion that most people will contend with. And these are difficult questions to meter out, but I will not abandon the cause of online anonymity, because I think an internet without online anonymity will do so much more harm than one with it. Speaking of online anonymity, 4chan and Kiwi Farms are suing the UK over its age verification law. This is a piece by 404 Media talking about it. And the truth of the matter is, they are objectively in the right here when it comes to why does the UK have the right, or why does a UK institution have the right to suppress free speech in the United States? Now, I'm in Canada. I actually don't have the same free speech protections that somebody in the United States does, or especially a company and an institution in the States has. And so it's actually kind of fascinating to me to watch this develop and understand what does this mean for the future of cyberspace as a whole. Because one of the things that will get discussed is people will say, oh, well, actually, it's good that governments can censor the internet or control who can participate online, because that is an issue of their government sovereignty. But the fact of the matter is that that government sovereignty comes at a direct consequence to the citizens. And so it's really important to ask ourselves, what are we empowering? Are we empowering a government to have control over the citizenship to do what? To do more of the same that governments have been doing to their populations? You know, many people are upset about what their governments are doing to them these days. And why would you give them more control over cyberspace when that's one of the few places it's easy for people to organize, connect, and share information about what's going on? The fact of the matter is, the mainstream discourse is losing so much trust because it's not representing what people are experiencing in their real lives. And so this particular lawsuit is fascinating because it will have serious implications for the future of an international cyberspace. And I actually think it is entirely possible that the given of one shared cyberspace may disappear as the UK builds its own great firewall of the United Kingdom, and many other countries will kind of cut themselves off. And that is a real loss. Because while Americans enjoy a particular level of free speech that is great and really should be generalized more across the world, the fact of the matter is, I think Americans may not truly appreciate the benefit they have from people in countries like mine, Canada, or the UK, or other countries, being able to talk about what the government's doing to them. Because if you can't reach people in other countries, maybe you're not going to get the warning of, hey, the governments are trying all these crazy things. And so I think one of the things various powers these days are now trying to fight back on is that I think they are very concerned about people being able to share information internationally. And the major way you stop that nowadays is by clamping down on online free speech. And so this is why I think this lawsuit, but also this broader trend, is so very important, because it also impacts smaller, decentralized alternatives to mainstream social media sites. For example, Mastodon is basically arguing it doesn't even have the means to comply with age verification laws. Because let's say for a moment that they build the feature into their software, it's entirely possible that somebody can build a patch the next day that removes that software, and these are independent operators. Yes, the main Mastodon.social instance can be compelled by the UK, and if they go along with it, if this lawsuit fails, yes, Mastodon.social, the main instance, can be forced to comply. However, that doesn't mean they then have the power to force every other Mastodon instance out there to comply, which raises many interesting technical, social, economic, and even legal questions about the state of these decentralized systems. And I think this is the big fight right now. I think governments across the world are experimenting, but the UK is the tip of the spear for this. Can they actually stop any alternatives from existing? I hope we live in a world where we can make sure there is real independent digital infrastructure. I hope we live in a world where there can be real independent alternatives to the digital serfdom that is being built around us. But we have to fight for it. We have to understand what's going on here. We have to contend with these issues. We have to engage with these problems. But the fact of the matter is, just like with GrapheneOS, just like with Monero, we have these problems where these tools exist, but if people don't use them, if people don't understand them, if people aren't interested in the problems they're trying to solve, ultimately they're going to fail. What all three of these issues and many other related issues all have as a problem is the fact of the matter is that the understanding and engagement of your average person absolutely matters. We need regular people on board with the Fediverse, with independence on Android, with independent digital currencies. We need these things to be understood, and this is a big part of why I do what I do. It's part of the reason why I'm really trying to get this update out, even though maybe it would have been a good idea to just let it slide and just publish these things as articles. But I do think it is really important to tie these different trends together, because they are effectively the same issue. The same issue here is that we have interesting, really promising technological solutions to many of the problems that are going on right now, but they ultimately cannot withstand a hostile environment. And we need to really think about what we are doing as individuals to either nurture or stifle that environment when it comes to these broader issues in cyberspace. And what's fascinating about this, and part of the reason why I think we're going to see some splinter nets going on, is because, for instance, somebody was asking Eugen about the legality of all these things, and he's basically arguing, look, you're probably also breaking laws in Afghanistan, Iran, North Korea, and so on. The question is, do you care? If you're running your own system on the free and open internet, really, what should we bow to authoritarian regimes? Should we build systems that allow us to comply with every insane law that some insane jurisdiction comes up with to really just undermine what everybody gets out of these things? I don't think that's the right answer. And it is important to realize that this is actually a real threat to independent operators of any size. If you run, independent social media, it is very important to ask, what are the risks we are putting on these people? And so this is why I think this lawsuit, the 4chan and Kiwi Farms are doing, is so important, because it is directly striking at the root of these questions. The fact of the matter is, are we going to concede a worldwide communication network of human beings connecting together? Are we going to give governments the power to veto that? Because that has real consequences. Specifically when it comes to Fediverse versus Blue Sky, and now they're also tracking Git repositories, it is important to ask, what decentralization truly means. there are going to be various different levels of how decentralized one system is or another system is. And it's really important to ask yourself, what do you want to participate in? Should I spend so much effort to build a presence on Blue Sky if it's not even decentralized? I'm on the Fediverse, and actually my servers have been blocked by some of the, you know, bigger, more mainstream servers, or, you know, servers of a particular political persuasion, but that doesn't affect me too much because there are still servers that do talk to me, so there are many users I can interact with. Anybody using Noster can communicate with my Fediverse instance over the different bridges and relays that exist in, on that system. And this is something I think is so important to this discussion, is that there is a huge difference between decentralization in practice and in theory. And I really like this tool for kind of just showing you just how different these systems really are. And it's kind of a great thing when we really think about how much better things can be, how much opportunity there is to make things truly decentralized, and how to actually build systems that allow communities to have some level of independence and autonomy. And I don't think freedom and independence are in any way contradictory. I think that's kind of the wedge that's being driven right now, is there is this idea that, oh, if we want individual autonomy, then we have to cut down on internet free speech or internet freedom, digital freedom across the board. But I don't believe that's true at all. What I believe is that there is so much potential if we actually embrace a radical idea of what we can accomplish in cyberspace, if we just begin to understand and wrestle with these issues. And so to me, these stories that are out there, these different trends that are going on, this is what I kind of wanted to impart in this update, because there's a lot of things moving right now, and I know it's complicated. I know there's a lot of technical details that you can really get sunk into, which are worth wrestling with. But I think what most people need to take away from these instances is we should all be invested in digital freedom. We should all be invested in each other's privacy and each other's ability to have digital autonomy and not be locked into so many different tyrannical or otherwise just rent-seeking systems and out there, which is a big part of the reason why I'm so passionate about free software, about decentralization, about many of the exciting things that are going on in cyberspace right now. I don't think that the hope in a better digital freedom is worthless. I actually think it can do a lot of good. But the truth of the matter is hope should not be blind. We should understand what we are facing, and we should really contend with the questions that are being asked in our time. Because no matter what happens, our future descendants will always inherit the cyberspace we give to them, not the one we wish. We have to be more careful about what we are allowing to happen to cyberspace, to our digital landscape, so that future generations aren't encountering problems we don't even understand. Because it's hard to stay up to date and wrestle with these difficult questions if we are not even willing to look around and experiment and try things and wrestle with how these things work, not just in theory, but also in practice. And so I'm trying to really bring your attention to the many different facets of these issues and broaden your understanding of freedom tech, because there is no silver bullet. There is no one system that if everybody just used that, everything would be better. In practice, things get ugly and the world evolves, the world changes. And so we absolutely have to be serious in facing these things and understanding what we are contending with, so that we can work to build a better direction. Because I wholeheartedly believe a better direction is absolutely possible. There is so much potential. There is so much to be excited about. I am just so thrilled that as bad as things are right now, the bar to make things better is so incredibly low if you look at it that way. So thank you so much for joining me. I know this has been a little late, and I apologize for getting this out late. I really do want to continue working on my RSS reader, and so that's kind of my top... I really do want to continue working on my RSS reader, which is going to be my top priority this month, so you're not going to hear from me as much. I might try to get one article out just to say something, depending on what's going on this month. But I really wanted to leave you with this update so that as I'm working on this, You understand why. You understand why I'm making some of the decisions I'm making and going about this project, why I've talked about many of the things I've talked about in the way, and what you can look forward to moving in the future, because I have a lot of exciting ideas for this project, but I will admit, I do need more support. I do need some feedback when it comes to what I'm trying to do, and part of that is I am in a bit of a bind. My ability to devote as much time as I would like to on this stuff is limited, and so that's why I'm trying to ration my energies toward the RSS reader, and so that's where my attention is going to be in the short term. I'm going to ask that you be patient with me. I'm hoping I will have an exciting update in early October talking about the progress I've made this month, and as I mentioned before, that talking about this is part of my way of trying to be more accountable and push more effort in that direction. But I will say I do need your help to get this message out. The fact of the matter is my growth, or at least attention as far as this project concern, is not growing. It's, and some people are blaming Substack for the way that works, but to be fair, I haven't put all my eggs in Substack. I have my own PeerTube, I have my own website, I've tried to engage with different decentralized systems across the board. And so honestly, I would encourage you to go back through anything I've made and maybe share that with somebody you think might be interested in something I've written or produced in the past, because I need help. I need more people to really support this project. I need more people to be interested in sharing it, because things are in a dicey way right now. And truthfully, I have a lot on my plate. So this is me just trying to do the best I can. I really do want to finish the 1.0 version of that RSS reader by the end of the year. And I think that's a big goal, but it's something I want to push as hard as I can for. So especially over the next couple of months, you're not going to be hearing about me. You're not going to hear from me as much, but I think it will really pay off with an actual tangible software that people can actually use to directly solve many of the pressing and seriously concerning censorship issues that are going on right now. And I want to do more explaining of that as it comes closer to fruition. The fact that right now it already works with Tor and I2P is really an exciting development. I think there's so much potential in what this tool can deliver if I really continue to work on it. And I am so excited to share with you what that will mean once it all starts coming together. My plan initially is just to launch on Linux for the 1.0. Depending on how easy it is to set up for Windows, I will also create a Windows version. I have a friend who's going to be very generously helping me get a Mac version out once it's ready. So sometime by the end of the year, you can expect some sort of software to come from me. And I'm very excited to make it real, because I have really solved all the hard problems of this project. There's a few difficult things I need to figure out, but I have been building so many things in the background to understand the problem I'm trying to tackle, and it's something really exciting. And the thing I want to tease is that once I am complete this project, once this project is done and out and people are enjoying it and I'm using it myself, because the whole reason I wanted to build this was to build something for myself, I have another project that is just as much as a game changer. Even though these are simple tools, I mean, a better programmer than me could probably make them in much less time, but the fact of the matter is I have some very exciting ideas, because I've been wrestling with all these technical issues about what's wrong with our digital landscape and what that actually means for the future of cyberspace. I've been really trying to think of where I can strategically put my efforts, because I know I have a lot on my plate these days. I know I have a lot going on. I know I'm struggling with many different things in the face of things that have happened to me, but I am very excited that with the insight I have accrued by doing the Libra Solutions Network over the last couple of years, I am now at a point where I think I can really build game-changing solutions to this stuff and actually provide real software, which, hey, isn't everything. You do need people to actually understand it. You do need people to actually use it, but I think it will be a significant change. And so to all of you who are still listening as I ramble on, I really, really do appreciate you being here. I appreciate you listening. It means the world to me that people are interested in what I am trying to share with the world. And I hope I will do you proud, as by the end of this year, I'll have this out and hopefully it'll be in good shape. So thank you for this update. As I mentioned, I'm going to be a bit quieter. I'm going to be busy with this, but I hope you can reflect on what I've uploaded. on what I've shared in this video, and I hope it gives you inspiration for where you want to go in the future. Thank you.